This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a major victory for brand workers. Attorney Daniel Gross visits us today in the studio to talk about the huge settlement and successful organizing drive in a large sweatshop here in New York, where the workers have joined the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. Chicago's ex-mayor, Richard Daley, has been ordered by a federal judge to submit himself to a deposition and answer questions about an allegation that he conspired to cover up police torture in Chicago for over 30 years. Flint Taylor, the attorney handling the lawsuit, joins us today on Law and Disorder.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Probably not well known to a lot of our listeners, Deborah Evanson was, as you said, a close friend, and she really made her mark in the last few years because of Cuba and her representation of the Cuban government through her law firm, Rabinowitz, Boundin, Standard, Krinsky, and Lieberman. She was a close friend, as you said. She stayed at my house when she was in New York. Oftentimes, she would have to spend a lot of time in Cuba in the representation of the government, doing cases from protecting the trademarks of Cuba to a variety of other issues on behalf of the Cuban government.
Well, she was really a foremost protector of Cuban sovereignty for almost 20 years. She was also the president of the Lawyers Guild. She was one of those generations of women our age who went to law school, became leaders in human rights litigation, in teaching, in progressive politics.
And she also wrote two important books on Cuba. One is, I think, probably the only book in English that's on the Cuban legal system, the Cuban Constitution, how issues are decided in Cuba. You know, I'm sure people in this country think, well, you know, it's a communist country. Whatever the boss says, that's it, and there's no law. But in fact, there is established legal system in Cuba with all kinds of rights and obligations of people under their constitution, including obligations of the government to make sure there's a real social safety net for people. And I think it's called something like Cuba Law in the Balance, something like that, but a very fine book. And she wrote another, I think it's a monograph or sort of a book on the Cuban healthcare system, and also very important. And you can get those books or look them up. Again, it's Deborah Evanson. And so she did put an extraordinary part of her life into ensuring that Cuba, the Cuban model, and Cuba would continue to survive as a country that people can look at, emulate, and otherwise share with their comrades.
I just want to read one thought that her law associate, Michael Krinsky, said in a National Lawyers Guild press release. Michael said that so many in Havana and such a diverse group of people, high government officials, ordinary workers, intellectuals, artists, academics, and lawyers, deeply mourn her passing as a personal loss is a testament to Deborah's great integrity, contributions, and humanity. We'll link to the National Lawyers Guild remembrance of Deborah Evanson on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
If you ever wondered what your right was to video or photograph cops in action, we're beginning to get an answer out of the First Circuit Court of Appeals, a federal court in Boston. It's always been a question. If I see a cop arresting somebody, handcuffing him, beating him, do I have a right to stand there and do a video? Is that part of my First Amendment rights? Well, the First Circuit has said, yes, it is. That's a great ruling. I would actually encourage everybody they can to videotape the cops in action. We'll defend you if you get busted, we'll being the broader National Lawyers Guild and Center for Constitutional Rights. Well, here's what happened in this case. A Boston lawyer who was suing the city and police officers because he was arrested for using his cell phone to record a drug arrest on the Boston Commons. He won a victory when the court said that officers could not claim that they were immune from the lawsuit. And in fact, the court went out of its way to say that there was a constitutionally protected right to videotape police carrying out their duties in public. Now, it's interesting. When we think about the First Amendment, we think it's our right to speak in an unfettered way. But the court went on to say it's also our right to gather information in an unfettered way, and that the government can't limit the stock of information from which members of the public may draw. One of the claims by the police here was that the man who was a lawyer taking this video with his cell phone wasn't a journalist. And while journalists might have a right to videotape, normal citizens, lawyers, anybody else, do not. The court said that that distinction was bogus, particularly now that technology and society have made the lines between private citizens and journalists difficult to draw. We're all journalists, essentially, now that we all have video phones, camera phones, and all kinds of things. The court finally said that the Boston Common is the oldest city park in the United States and is the apotheosis of a public forum, and therefore absolute right to videotape cops. So everybody, take out your cell phones, take out your cameras, take out your critter cams, put them on the lampposts. Let's get the cops doing what they do best, arresting and beating the innocent. This September 9th is the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the Attica Rebellion. As many of you may know, that was the rebellion that was ended by the slaughter of dozens of inmates and a number of guards by the state of New York, its police, its National Guard, and others. As you may not know, it was also the first case that I, Michael Ratner, ever worked on. It was my first day of work at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill Kunstler was up at Attica trying to negotiate between the guards and the prison officials and the state. When those negotiations failed, that's when the state came in firing, firing, firing. I was sent up to Attica immediately afterwards to interview people in the prison ward who'd been tortured, otherwise abused, in the aftermath. The center then filed an early case. It was my first case that I ever filed, in an effort to get the guards prosecuted, because the state was only prosecuting the inmates and not the guards. Ultimately, while our case failed, the principal did not. And we wound up, and in the end of many years of litigation by many people, all of the cases against the inmates were dropped. And of course, there were no prosecutions against the guards, but no one got prosecuted. In any case, this September 9th, on the anniversary, in New York City, there is a program to commemorate this historic rebellion. Attica is all of us. It's Friday, September 9th, 7 to 10 p.m. at 490 Riverside Drive, New York. Again, that's 490 Riverside Drive, New York, 7 to 10. The program is Attica is all of us, and that is the Riverside Church. Be there to commemorate this historic and moving occasion. Sadly, an historic and moving occasion that can certainly happen again, considering the state of our prisons in the United States. Think Attica, think Pelican Bay, and think we must end the prison system in the United States.
A bitterly contested campaign against PurePak, a food distribution warehouse giant, reached a settlement of $470,000 for workers who had their wages illegally withheld, and recognized their union, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. The workers organized with Focus on the Food Chain, Brand Workers and International Workers of the World, to challenge sweatshop conditions, wage theft, retaliation, and discrimination in the sprawling industrial corridor of food processing and distribution that services New York City markets and restaurants. Daniel Gross, an attorney and the executive director of Brand Workers, said, "The conditions in this sector are deplorable and systemic, but as the PurePak workers have shown, positive workplace change can and will be won." Daniel joins us in the studio today to talk about the victory and the continued efforts to improve working conditions amongst the largely illegal immigrant workers in the food processing industry in New York City. Attorney Daniel Gross, you're with Brand Workers. You've been organizing sweatshop workers in the food distribution industry here in New York City, out in Brooklyn and Queens, and you've had an astounding victory. We want to congratulate you on the PurePak victory and ask you about what was at stake and what are the dimensions of the victory.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, and as always, it's a real delight to be here with you on Law & Disorder. PurePak is typical of an industrial corridor of food processing and distribution warehouses, which really service a tremendous amount of food to restaurants and supermarkets in New York. So whether you're eating tortillas or drinking a soda or, you know, eating seafood or really you name it, much of what we end up eating at New York restaurants and purchasing from supermarkets are either processed or distributed from an outright corridor of sweatshops. PurePak is a distributor of restaurant and food supplies to Chinese restaurants, cafes, and bakeries, some of the landmark Chinese eateries in New York City are serviced by PurePak. They distribute huge quantities of rice, cooking oil, chopsticks, you name it. Again, outright sweatshop, tremendous amount of wage theft, hundreds of thousands of dollars in withheld overtime, minimum wage, vicious retaliation against workers who stand up for their rights, incredibly exhausting, long shifts, very heavy work, and forced to do it at unsafe speeds.
Well, you got them to give back these workers $470,000, which is really astounding. And what's unique about brand workers and what you do, I think, is that you're both in the courts and outside of the courts. Talk to us about how you organized this campaign for these really, you know, vulnerable workers.
Well, you've hit it right on the head. And what we do is we facilitate worker-led comprehensive campaigns, which do, as you pointed out, include substantial litigation components, but also organizing on the shop floor and very intense, determined grassroots advocacy. So in this particular campaign at PurePak, the workers, all recent immigrants from Latin America, all Spanish speakers, launched an incredibly powerful workplace justice campaign, which saw PurePak's most important restaurant, cafe, and customers stop purchasing huge quantities of PurePak's products until the workers' rights were respected. And that's what ultimately brought PurePak to the table and led to the victory.
And were you also in the NLRB and in the federal courts while you were organizing the retail customers of PurePak?
There was a sprawling set of litigation in federal court, in the National Labor Relations Board. The company used several tactics to try to avoid accountability here, but the main approach that they used is they engaged in sham sales of the company. So they'd fraudulently transfer assets, they'd rebrand the company, and so the company was actually originally called Easy Supply. Easy Supply escaped liability by purporting to go out of business, and now same factory, same truck, same product, same customers, was called Sunrise Plus.
So did you get a court ruling saying they were identical?
Yes, so we caught up finally with Sunrise Plus, and then lo and behold, the company engaged in another sham sale, and that created PurePak. And finally, with this comprehensive agreement, we were able to force the company to acknowledge that, indeed, PurePak was Sunrise Plus, was Easy Supply. You mentioned the nearly $500,000 in illegally withheld overtime and minimum wage and retaliation compensation we recovered. But we also, again, through the force of the workers and their initiative, were able to win a binding code of conduct, which creates very powerful protective mechanisms for collective activity going forward. We won compliance with all workplace laws in this private agreement, which includes health and safety laws, anti-discrimination, and after this really withering fight, and it's just a testament to the courage of these workers and their leadership, we were able to win recognition for the industrial workers of the world as the exclusive bargaining agent for PurePak workers. So it was really by far the biggest victory for Focus on the Food Chain, which is this campaign organizing, and really just we're delighted to partner with these workers in the food processing and distribution warehouses of New York.
You know, the industrial workers of the world are legendary, going back 100 years before the First World War, when they were one of the major forces in fighting for the rights of workers like the kind that you represent, not the privileged truck drivers, say, but the guys that were in the mines and the mills and the lumber yards. And it's really, I think, an extension of what was going on 100 years ago is what's going on now with these super exploited workers. And it really is thrilling to hear the IWW coming back into the fore. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself and about your interest in the IWW. How did you get to do what you're doing? Talk to us about what happened to you once you got into law school and came out.
Yeah, well, my story definitely predates law school. You know, I was a low-wage worker in many sectors, mostly retail and fast food. And it was my experience working at Borders Books and Music, which, of course, is now bankrupt, but this was years ago, and really just felt the sting of a multinational employer, which at the time was highly profitable, but didn't pay a fair wage, offered extremely insecure and unpredictable schedules, and employed a management force which really showed a tremendous disrespect for rank-and-file workers. Sort of in that situation, felt something was wrong and didn't quite know what to do about it, and ended up sort of reaching out into the world, who can help in this kind of situation? And in that context, I encountered the industrial workers of the world. And was really welcomed and sort of mentored and really educated about not only the rights of workers and not only the labor movement, but a particular viewpoint on social change and on labor organizing. And that's this idea that it's workers themselves, not union bureaucrats, not government officials, who are really uniquely positioned to both make change at work, but also on a larger level, form a powerful force, a fighting force that can look to capitalism as a system and challenge it and hopefully, if we do our jobs right, ultimately overcome it.
Attorney Daniel Gross, you came up the hard way through Starbucks. In fact, that's how I first met you, because Attorney Len Weinglass was representing you then. Tell us about your experience trying to organize in Starbucks.
I started working at Starbucks in 2003, and even by the abysmal standards of retail and fast food, Starbucks is a truly aggressively anti-worker company, and no one has any guaranteed hours. Their healthcare message is a total myth. They actually insure a lower percentage of their workforce than Walmart, and they're aggressively anti-union, just absolutely zero respect for the right of free association. So my coworkers and I got together and began organizing using the IWW Solidarity Unionism model, which, again, is essentially quite simple. It's workers coming together on their own and really forming a plan, a strategy, and developing trust and a relationship with each other, and then carrying out direct action around issues of concern. At Starbucks, the big issues being securing the work schedule so you have some predictability of your income and your life, making sure there's regular raises, and cutting down on the arbitrariness of management and disrespect.
What kind of direct actions did you do at Starbucks?
Oh, you name it. Whatever works. I mean, we had 44 Starbucks stores in New York City that were infested with rats and insects. So we did some worker citizen journalism, and we got a whole host of videos and photos of these rats and roaches, and we inflated a huge, very huge inflatable rat in front of one of the stores, and we shared our photographic and video evidence with the press. It was a wonderful sight to see district managers scrambling to the stores, kind of getting on their hands and knees, patching up holes in the floor, and making sure they're trying to improve the infestation issue. So everything from militant pickets to actions on the shop floor, really, you name it, anything that would win on issues we cared about, whether it was respect for a worker who was being discriminated against, whether it was a question of a insecure work schedule, we'd stick together and take action. And that initial effort in New York, extremely proud to say, has now spread all around the country. And we have Starbucks baristas who are organizing with the Red IWW membership card in their pockets and organizing, recruiting, building power, and winning on important issues of concern. The company is still engaged in really a scorched earth effort, complete disrespect for the right to organize and free association. But, workers are determined, and we have some extremely spirited, energetic leaders amongst baristas all around the country. And so it's a really wonderful campaign.
Daniel Gross, let me switch subjects and ask you if you'd comment on what I think is a significant ruling by the National Labor Relations Board in the Zonos Maven case. Will you first tell our listeners what the NLRB is and what the Zonos Maven ruling means in terms of workers' rights?
Absolutely, Michael, and thank you for asking that, because the ruling has really gone undernoticed by the press and others, and it's extremely important and troubling. The NLRB is the administrative agency charged under federal law with administering union management affairs, and they have a jurisdiction over cases under the National Labor Relations Act in the first instance. And Mizonos Maven Bakery, interestingly enough, as we've been talking about the New York City sweatshops in the food processing and distribution industry, Mizonos Maven is none other than a New York City food production sweatshop. And so that's the company which has now changed a national law for all undocumented workers who are interested in organizing. Mizonos Maven was cheating workers out of wages, disrespecting immigrant workers, Latinos and Latinas, and the workers came together. They didn't join a union, but they connected with some community groups and worker center type groups and legal groups, and they took collective action together to reclaim the stolen wages. It was a wonderful movement over at this sweatshop, and Mizonos Maven, as is extremely common in this sector, illegally started firing workers, just throwing them out of their jobs for the simple fact that they had the audacity to stand up really for the most basic labor rights. You know, we're not even talking here about health care, retirement. We're talking about the basic minimums under the law, like the right to be paid minimum wage, which are at issue in these sweatshops. The case of Mizonos actually turned in a very positive direction at the trial level. Unlike a very powerful, unfortunately, precedent in the Supreme Court called Hoffman Plastic, the employer in Mizonos did not ask workers for immigration documentation when they were hired. The boss wasn't interested. The boss was interested in hardworking people that were going to deliver value to the enterprise, and that's what the boss got with this group of workers. It was only when the workers were illegally retaliated against and fired for asserting their rights that the boss raised at the labor board this question of immigration status. And the boss's argument was, these folks are undocumented, and undocumented workers, according to the boss's argument, under the Hoffman Plastic case, are not entitled to back pay. The problem for the employer, the problem for Mizonos was, Hoffman involved an employer, supposedly the Supreme Court found, that did not know that the worker in question who was retaliated against was undocumented. The court found that the boss had been defrauded by fake documents and was hoodwinked and had no idea that the company was employing an undocumented worker. To the contrary, Mizonos absolutely had no interest, was in violation of immigration law, never checked papers, was never interested. So the trial judge at the labor board took really Justice Breyer's dissent in the Hoffman Plastic case and said, no, this employer is not the innocent employer who was defrauded by an undocumented worker. This is a knowing employer who willingly violated immigration law, now comes before the court and says, I shouldn't have to pay a penny of back pay. And so the trial court correctly held that Hoffman did not control a case, and this is how many sweatshops operate, where either documents are not requested or, you know, workers will be asked to go buy something from somewhere and they'll show whatever it is and the boss will wink, wink, nod, nod, you're hired. That's the typical practice in a sweatshop. So it was critical precedent for all of us who are organizing with our brothers and sisters in the workforce who are undocumented. It was critical precedent saying, no, the employer cannot get 100% discount on back pay just because they decide to become concerned with allegations around immigration status in a labor board case.
You know, Daniel, I litigate injury cases, and the law in New York is the same with respect to injured people. An injured person, if it turns up that that person was an undocumented person, cannot enforce a claim for back wages. So let's say a guy loses his leg. Somebody runs him over and he loses his leg. The bad guy doesn't have to pay this one-legged man anything because he didn't have documents. It's the same thing with labor law as it is with tort law. That's the direction that things have been going in. With respect to the current work that Brand Workers is doing, I know the FLAM campaign is going on, and I wanted to ask you about what successes you're having there, and then what our listeners might do to get further news and try to help you guys.
Absolutely. And let me just conclude before moving into FLAM on Mizonos. The National Labor Relations Board, under Obama's chairman of the board, Wilma Liebman, did reverse the trial judge in Mizonos. And the current national labor law of the land, which has been created by this New York food sweatshop, is that undocumented workers, even in the case of an employer who never was concerned about immigration status, they're completely denied back pay. And I think it's very significant to point out that this ruling will increase the proliferation of sweatshops in our economy, because it's the sweatshops who will go and reach out for workers who have now a second-class status.
Knowing they can stiff them in the end.
And I think our posture going forward in this case is not just to wring our hands and say, oh, this is so sad, we have a truly bigoted system, which it is that. What we're saying fervently out there is that Mizonos is a major message to those of us organizing at the base that we need to emphasize even more direct action, tight, strong organizing at the base, cultivating community allies, and really waging withering campaigns based on workers' own initiatives that don't, in fact, depend on needing to win a court case. Because in this particular area, back pay after being illegally retaliated against, the courthouse doors are now closed to undocumented workers in the United States.
Daniel Gross, talk to us about what Brand Workers are doing currently, particularly with the FLAM campaign.
Absolutely. So FLAM, again, is a very typical sweatshop in New York's food processing and distribution sector. It's a kosher producer and distributor of appetizing products, including the Sonny and Joe's hummus brand. They're the distributor of Tanuva, which is the largest global kosher cheese company. FLAM is based in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They exploit recent immigrants from Latin America. It's an all-white set of top executives, all Latino workforce, who was subjected to vicious exploitation, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And they've got rabbis supervising the processing of this food, blessing the food.
That's absolutely correct. And the Latino workers there, unfortunately, are certainly not blessed, and their well-being is not of interest, apparently, to the mainstream kosher authorities. The workers were subjected to determined and continual theft of their wages, top executives referring to the workers in extremely derogatory terms, the general manager referring to Latinos and Latinas as cockroaches and spiders, tarantulas, just extreme, extreme abuse, very long 13-hour days, 6 days a week, extremely heavy work, workers being forced to work to exhaustion, so just a really brutal place to work. And again, as we keep seeing, when the workers stood up for their most basic labor rights, they were subjected to fierce and immediate retaliation. 17 workers fired altogether for standing up for one another. And the company just showed complete disregard for the rule of law. Unfortunately for the company, the workers refused to back down, and they are waging what is just an extremely dynamic and powerful workplace justice campaign. Through grassroots advocacy on the street every week, week after week, the workers have now persuaded over 65 of the most prominent high-volume supermarket locations in New York, including the famous Zabar's, including Fairway, including Food Emporium, to stop selling FLAM, Sonny and Joe's hummus until the workers' rights are respected. So the workers are very mobilized now, and they are moving forward aggressively towards victory and towards respect for their rights. What the workers are emphasizing at this time is the relationship of FLAM to Tanuva. So again, Tanuva is the global market leader in kosher cheese. They're out of Israel. They're owned by an enormous and secretive private equity company called Apax Partners. It has business interests all around the world. And Tanuva, this extremely profitable company, many say a monopoly, comes to the New York metropolitan market And do they choose a unionized distributor to distribute their products to New York supermarkets? No. They choose Flom, an outright sweatshop, which, as I mentioned, the food industry has now come to nearly a consensus that Flom is not currently a company worthy of doing business with. Tanuva, regrettably, is really out of step with this growing consensus in the food industry and refuses to engage Flom and use its significant influence. About 50%, we think, of the volume going out on Flom's trucks is actually Tanuva. And the company just refuses, including Apex, their owner, refuses to engage with Flom and promote ethics and human rights in their distribution chain. So we've been really privileged to work with some fantastic rabbis, with the Uri Letzedek social justice organization. 12 of the really top progressive rabbis in the country have reached out to Tanuva, have written, have called, and are attempting to engage Tanuva. Tanuva ever so slowly is moving. They've now at least called on Flom to resolve the dispute. Fast is the word that they used. But Tanuva still refuses to meaningfully engage with Flom and say, you know what, you've got to comport with the rule of law, or you know what, Tanuva ought to find a socially responsible unionized distributor in the city of New York.
So, Daniel, what can our listeners do to check in with brand workers and come to support you? You got a website?
Absolutely. So the workers just did a powerful action at Apex's New York headquarters, calling on Tanuva to use its influence with Flom or find a socially responsible distributor. It was a fantastic action. We had rabbis, we had workers, we had community allies from Domestic Workers United, Families for Freedom, UFCW Local 1500, you name it. We were out on the streets in Midtown. And building on that action, we are calling for a global day of action for justice at Tanuva, calling on Tanuva to respect its distribution employees, these immigrants in New York who are bringing the products to market. And all kinds of information about all of this work is available on the web. For our Facebook listeners, they should go to Focus on the Food Chain on Facebook. On the web, you can connect with brand workers at brandworkers.org. Brand Workers is also on Twitter. And you can also connect with the IWW, the global website is IWW.org, and the New York City IWW is at wobblycity.org.
Well, Daniel Gross, thank you so much for coming on Law & Disorder. I think we'll announce to our listeners that we're going to leave you with a famous song written by an IWW poet, Ralph Chapin. It's called Solidarity Forever, and that's what we wish to all the people that you work with, Daniel. Thanks again.
It's always such a delight, Michael. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Solidarity forever.
Blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have.
We continue to bring updates on the ongoing Chicago police torture scandal revolving around former Chicago police commander John Burge. Recently, a courageous federal judge ruled that former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley will be kept as a defendant in a lawsuit where he is charged with conspiring to cover up police abuse and torture. As many listeners may know, Burge is now serving a 4.5-year prison sentence for obstructing justice and lying about his torturing over 100 African-American men to obtain false confessions. The People's Law Office brought the current Daley case in 2005, and the city of Chicago has refused to settle it. The federal judge ruled in favor of attorney Flint Taylor, who's representing the torture victims, and ordered that Mayor Daley must present himself for a deposition on September 8th of this year. We're joined now by attorney Flint Taylor to talk more about the situation. Flint, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be back, Mike.
Flint, the motto that I liked most when I was in law school, which I've written in my date book, and which is what you've done there in Chicago by getting Mayor Daley in the target, is fiat justa caecolum, which means do justice even if the heavens fall. And when I read that Sun-Times article about that courageous federal judge saying that Daley is still in the lawsuit and that you can depose him in September, I thought, the heavens in Chicago are falling. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Sometimes it seems that way, given how long we've been pursuing Daley in the various civil suits and trying to hold him in, as part of a conspiracy.
Let's just, in a nutshell, give us the background to how Daley got to be in a situation where the judge ordered him to come and submit himself to a deposition by you. How did Daley get there? What happened that caused all this to happen?
Well, the factual background is that Daley was the state's attorney of Cook County for 8 years in the 80s. During that period of time, he was specifically informed of police torture in various cases. Instead of doing anything about it and dealing with the torturers, John Burge and company, he continued to encourage it by prosecuting men who had been falsely arrested and charged based on tortured confessions, sending many of them to death row. When he left state's attorney and became the mayor in 1989, he continued to have an active role in the cover-up of the torture practice and took several specific acts, the most significant of which was in the early 90s, the police department in an internal report found that there was systematic police torture under John Burge, and Daley, along with the police superintendent at that time, Leroy Martin, At first attempted to suppress that report, and then we were able to get it ordered publicly released, and then they moved to discredit it and to say it was only rumors and innuendos rather than acting on it. So he had at various times, as a chief law enforcement and as chief executive of the city of Chicago and Cook County, respectively, the power and the obligation to act, and if he did, we wouldn't have had all these men on death row, we wouldn't have had all these men in the penitentiary, and we wouldn't have had all these men tortured. So that was always the basis of our claim against Daley. We brought it several times in lawsuits, starting in 2003, when several men were pardoned and brought lawsuits. Judges had consistently turned their backs on that claim, both against him and against his first assistant, Richard Devine, who later went on to be the state's attorney of Cook County. But recently, Judge Pallmeyer, a federal judge here, didn't turn her back on the allegations of conspiracy. And she held Daley in the case based on civil rights violations of conspiracy law. And based on those facts that I just recited to you and many more that in detail laid out what Daley's role and continuing role was and is in the scandal. So when she held him in the case, we then moved to have his deposition, or we noticed his deposition for early September. He probably could be deposed even if he weren't a defendant, but he, in fact, is a defendant, and that makes it an even stronger case for taking his deposition. The Sun-Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and NBC5 here got a hold of the story and put it on the front pages, big black and white headline, Daley the Defendant. Top of the 10 o'clock news, exclusive report. It then became a major news story within the news cycle of 24 to 48 hours. Then the new mayor, Rahm Emanuel, who has successfully tiptoed past this issue both in the campaign and now as the first 100 days of his mayor, had to respond to it. And at first he kind of responded by not responding, and then we called him out on that. The next week, he did an exclusive interview where he said it was time to end these cases. This time, a big black on white headline instead of, I forget, one was white on black and one was white, black on white, but huge headlines now in the Sun-Times, time to end it. He went on to say it was time to end these cases. We haven't yet seen any evidence that they want to end these cases. They've paid over $13 million to private lawyers to defend these civil cases that we're in, but we take the mayor at his word, and that we're hopeful that this will indeed lead to settlements and just resolution and compensation for the men who have been tortured.
If these cases are settled, and first of all, let me ask you, how many cases are outstanding where justice needs to be done? What, how many are we talking about?
Well, there are six men who have lawsuits in court. Unfortunately, because of the statute of limitations, most of the torture victims and survivors don't have lawsuits because the torture has long since passed. The men who have the lawsuits, it's because they have been recently exonerated, so their cases start from the date of their exonerations. So there's six of those men. The city's indicated after this time to end it that there might be an asterisk to it, and that is time to end some of them. I think they're going to continue to fight some of the cases and settle some of the cases, is what we've found out since that big headline. Another thing that happened simultaneously, which was extremely important, was that there are still 15 men behind bars here in Illinois based on tortured confessions that John Burge and the Area 2 torturers coerced from them. And we've been fighting along with Northwestern and a lot of community organizations to have them all get new hearings, like happened in the Ramparts case in L.A. and in Philadelphia, that any case that's tainted by a tortured confession should have a new hearing to determine whether, in fact, those confessions were tortured or not. And if so, those cases should either be dismissed or retried without the confessions. One man recently got a hearing. The appellate court affirmed the right to a hearing, and the special prosecutor took it to the Supreme Court of Illinois, arguing that it was, quote, harmless error to torture the confession because there was other evidence sufficient to convict him. Now, that's, you know, a pretty outlandish position to take, particularly in light of the precedent here in the Illinois Supreme Court. In any event, we were all fortunate enough to organize an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in that case, and we got an all-star lineup of prosecutors, former Governor Thompson, believe it or not, Jim Thompson, some very leading former U.S. attorneys, judges, Congressman Danny Davis, Congressman Bobby Rush, several African-American aldermen. In other words, quite a list of friends of the courts supporting the right not only of this man, Stanley Rice, affirming the Supreme Court affirming his right to a hearing, but that the Supreme Court should step out and declare that all the men remaining behind bars should have hearings. So these two hit at exactly the same day, the same time that the Daily issue was being front-paged and editorialized. The amicus brief was coming in behind it, and that issue was being raised, and ultimately there were editorials in both newspapers saying that all these men should have new hearings. So
we don't have a decision on that yet, though, right?
No, there'll be argument on that case in September.
What is going to happen with Daly? Even if they settle some of these cases, and as you predict, they don't settle all of them, Daly's not going to get off the hook in terms of having to explain his role, is he?
Well, that's a good question. We noticed the deposition for September. They moved to reconsider his being joined in the lawsuit, and we're assuming that they're going to fight doing the deposition in September and try to, at the very least, postpone it. I think that one of the cases, not surprisingly, a cynic might say, that they want to settle is the Michael Tillman case, which is the case where he's been held as a defendant and the case where he's being noticed to be deposed. So we're in this position of, there's nothing I'd like more to do than to depose Richard Daly.
There's nothing I would like more to do than be a fly on the wall in that room when you're deposing him.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think it might be worth the price of admission, and it certainly would be videotaped, and we'd certainly fight very hard for it to be something that would be of general viewability and not under some kind of protective order, which I'm sure they would seek to obtain. But on the other hand, if we have clients to represent.
Of course.
And if, in fact, the quid pro quo here is a just settlement for the men that are going to depose Daley and whom the judge has held him in their cases, or their case, that being Pillman, then that would be what would be resolved, and Daley might walk from his deposition.
Well, I'm sure he's anxious to do that. I read in the Sun-Times article where you were asked by a reporter what Daley could expect, and you said, I'm sure that Mayor Daley is looking forward to a seven-hour deposition.
Exactly. I'm sure they would try to very much narrow the issues, but it seems to me that we start when he decided not to to prosecute and to investigate John Burge when he got the evidence in 1982, and we finished when he walked out the door this past year with the defense of Burge still a city obligation that he approved. All that time in between, there are various overt acts that he took and actions that he didn't take that make him an actor in this scandal from almost the beginning to almost the end.
So what does he do when you're deposing him? Say he doesn't remember? Take the Fifth Amendment? Those positions are untenable in terms of upholding his moral stature in the city. I mean, he's really in a fix.
Well, you would think so. He has moved. He's taken his entourage over to a Katten Muhsin, which is a big law firm here in the city. Not only has he moved there, his corporation counsel, Myra Georges, has moved there, and his former, I don't know if she's chief of staff or chief communications director, popped up over there as well. So he's situated in a big-time law firm, and you would think that the advice he might be getting from some of those lawyers would be, U.S. attorney here, Patrick Fitzgerald, has certainly not been timid in terms of going after Daley underlings. He has steered clear of going after Daley, either in the torture cases or in a myriad of other scandals of corruption that he's prosecuted people for here. I don't know whether Daley denial of some of the actions in this case would be tantamount to perjury that Fitzgerald would be interested in, but a cautious lawyer might be in a bit of a pickle to decide whether to advise him to take the Fifth, which I think publicly and politically that would be suicide almost, to throwing a fog machine, as it were, I don't recall this, I don't recall that, I don't recall my name type of thing, which I suppose would keep him out of the guillotine of perjury, but make him look even dumber than some people try to portray him.
But don't you have memorandums that you can demonstrate he looked at, that he signed off on?
There's a major memoranda that was sent from the police superintendent at that time to Daley, a kind of a CYA memo that the superintendent sent saying, I've been given this very powerful evidence of torture from a doctor over at the county hospital or the county jail. I know that this should be investigated, but I know that it might also, you know, interfere with the prosecution of the torture victims. And therefore, I'm not going to do anything unless you, Richard Daley, tell me to do it. And that memo he sent to Daley, and that exists. And Daley, it's well known now, and his first assistant, Richard Devine, decided not to move on Burge, but rather to continue with the prosecution of the torture victims who themselves had been charged in a very high-profile police killing. So
wow.
That was the kind of smoking gun, so to speak, where he started to be involved in this. And then, as I mentioned earlier, it just kind of continued and mushroomed as more and more torture victims were prosecuted based on tortured confessions. And, of course, the state's attorney of Cook County had to personally approve any request for the death penalty that was made by his office. So in those cases during the 80s of torture victims who were prosecuted on tortured confessions, Daley himself signed off on the requests, and there were a number of them, including Michael Pillman's case and including another client of mine, Ronald Kitchen, where the request was made for the death penalty. So you have him, even though he's probably immune for those actions because he was acting as a prosecutor, some of his other actions while he was a prosecutor, he's not immune for, and that helps to rope him into this long-standing conspiracy.
What a story this is, Flint. Do you have any predictions on what might be coming up in the near future for us?
Well, I don't like to make predictions because it may, you know, as you know, they can come back to haunt you. All I can say is we're going to continue to be going full steam ahead. We're preparing now an opposition to their motion to reconsider on Daley as the defendant in the Tillman case. We're open to discussing settlement, and we're also proceeding as if we're going to take his deposition on the 8th of September. If in fact, they attempt to continue it, they better have a pretty good reason. They better have shown us some real good faith in terms of where they're headed with regard to making a just settlement in the case. Otherwise, we're not going to take no for an answer.
Well, Flint Taylor, you go take that deposition. We'll have you back on Law and Disorder to report it all. We're in solidarity with you, and we just do great work down there. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, I'm glad to do it, Michael, anytime.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.